Access number 14983, Albert Shippen, Reel 8.
Mr. A. Shippen, Reel 8. Can we go back now, Mr. Shippen, to the beginning of your army career, and would you take me through the progression of advancement as you went, as the army life went on?
Well, obviously, I started as a boy at 14, and of course, we were on boy service from when we were 14 to 17 and a half. So we carried out all our bugling duties over that period, and as boy soldiers.
Were you, during that time, which you were a boy soldier, was there some form of promotion within that period? Were there senior boys or what have you?
Oh, yes. You became a senior boy and this kind of thing. And you weren't given any stripes or anything, but obviously within the community that we lived in, you knew who was a senior and who was a junior in this kind of thing. And of course, also when boys came in, new boys came in, you were probably given one of the junior boys to look after. And of course, you didn't have to take the rise out of him or belittle him in any way. You had to encourage him in his duties. And that all led up to the man management of it. And one of the things on boy service which I remember, regardless of where we were and this kind of thing, we had to be properly dressed at all times. And the number of times we got washed and combed our hair, and the sergeant in charge of that period was a chap called Ronnie Onefour, who was the drummer and the percussionist in the band. But he used to say to us, "Ah, well, you probably don't like it now, but when you start courting and this kind of thing, you'll preen yourselves up to like peacocks," because we used to have some peacocks down the at the castle, which was his reference to the peacock situation. But after we'd done our boys' service at 17 and a half, you then went on to man's service, as it was called, and you had to do your 3 months military training as a recruit. But of course, nine times out of ten, you knew as much about the weapons and thing as the instructors. In fact, when I went to do my training, I was put into F Company, which was like a holding company, and I had a 3 year good conduct stripe on my arm in a recruit platoon. So everybody in the recruit platoon used to look at me with awe, with having this 3 year service good conduct stripe on my arm, and in amongst the recruits, they couldn't understand why I'd been in 3.5 years. I was just doing my recruit training.
Where was that stripe positioned on your uniform?
Well, it was at the bottom of the cuff. It was turned upside down, chevron. That showed that you had over 3 years service in and had been recommended by the commanding officer for a good conduct stripe. If you had 2 chevrons upside down, you'd done 5 year. If you had 3 chevrons upside down, you'd done 9 year. These were encouraged more so in the band and bugles, because all of the people that was in the band and bugles who were promoted to lance corporal, because they used to say that the bandsmen were the gentlemen of the regiment, and a bandsman was equivalent to a lance corporal. Everybody who was a non-commissioned officer in the band of bugles wore 2 stripes, regardless. And of course, I suppose also that it give a bit flair to the uniforms that were worn in the band and bugles by seeing people with good conduct stripes on, and to the civilian population, they looked and said, oh, well, you know, what does that mean? He's got his stripes one way, he's got his stripes the other way, kind of thing. When you'd done 3 years and you were recommended, I suppose, and you went to the command officers and he said you've been recommended, went up on battalion orders, that you've been given your 3 year good conduct stripe, I suppose you said, well, I've achieved something in my 3 years.
There was no additional pay or anything?
No. Boy service pay was 2 shillings a day, regardless. And I think when we went on our man service, I think we went to 4 shillings.
What date did you go on to your man's service?
What day?
Date.
Well, I joined the army on the 15th of August 1941, so I was 14 then. So I would say I would think it would be about the summer of 44 when I went on to my actual man service.
And you would then go through all the drills that the male, or full adult soldier went through?
Oh, yes.
And you were in effect experiencing what they'd experienced?
Yes.
Although you were more of an onlooker?
Exactly, yes.
How did you actually find it when it came to doing it? I know you formed opinions and seen things going on, but how did you find it when it happened?
Well, I suppose that it was like a bushman's holiday, really, to put it bluntly. The instructor, the drill instructor trying to teach us how to turn left and right and about turn and this kind of thing, when we've been on the square for 3.5 years and been out and done precision drill and covered a multitude of parades and what have we throughout, it wasn't like the people that were doing the training there. Swing your arms left to right, not to cross your front and this kind of thing. Stamp your foot down, all this kind of thing. And like infantry drill, which you stood at ease and came to attention and stood at ease again, well, it was second nature to us. I mean, the majority of boys that was going onto the man service, before they went onto the man service, because they were in the guard room 2 or 3 times a week with the guards and this kind of thing, they knew more about the weapons and this kind of thing. The guard commanders, the sergeants and the NCOs that did the guard commander, 9 times out of 10 relied on the bugler to tell them what was going on and this kind of thing, how to keep the guard report right and what have we, would teach you about things, and we knew more about the grenades and everything and that, because while the NCOs were on guard, the majority of them were studying for the next day's lectures, and all the pamphlets and diagrams and that they took on with them, and during the night, because they couldn't go to sleep, the NCOs were looking through these pamphlets and diagrams, so we just would sit with them and they would talk to us, where they wouldn't talk to the guard because they were recruits. And they probably didn't belong to them, their platoon or company even. But where the bugle was concerned, they would probably say, well, sit down and talk through this kind of thing. We knew more about middle distance, about range finding, and this kind of thing, how to load a Bren gun magazine, what the working parts of a Bren. We could even be blindfolded and put them together again after taking the bits. So it was a second nature to you, and a busman's holiday, really. It was 3 months that you had to do, which was recorded in your AB 64 Part 1, which was the record that you carried. The AB 64 Part 2 was your pay book. And it was then published, I suppose, that you're a trained soldier. But of course, the other bugbear then was your age again, because we were only 17 and 9 months when we were trained soldiers. So once again, we were more or less going to get posted to the Young Soldiers Battalion, which was the 70th, which was, I think, at Battle Hill at that time in Barnet Castle, or they were going to send us back to the Regimental Depot, as it was known at that time, to the castle down the road half a mile away, to be buglers again.
Did you find it boring, knowing it all and having done so much of it already?
Well, I think, to be truthful, looking back, yes, because the thing about it was, the recruits, they were polishing the brasses and the boots and everything. Well, ours was up to that, well, mine was up to that standard, and I found that I had quite a lot of leisure time, which I spent in the education centre, or down at the Red Shield Flood, or the Naffy, or the cinema, where they didn't have that kind of elasticity that I had, because my kit was up to the scratch. I remember that I used to probably look for one who was not so conversant with military procedures and that, and probably spend an hour or so with him on a night and hand him out. And of course, the NCOs in the platoon would give you parade the platoon and march them to the evening meal tonight. So they got away a bit earlier than what they did, and things like that. You got they used to give you jobs, like NCOs jobs in this kind of thing. Take those men down to the weapon train stores and pick up the rifle aim and discs and all this kind of thing, because they knew, and also the people in the stores knew you, because they'd seen you as a bugler 1,000 times parading around the camp. So you got jobs like that. Take these men down, pick up the haversack rations. So you went into the cookhouse, which was second nature to you, and the cook sergeant says, "Hello, bugler, how are you getting on?" Like, you know, I said, "Well, I'm in the training company." "Oh, well, are you enjoying it?" and this kind of thing. So you were well known, because you promulgated around the camp for 3.5 years being a bugler. So you were known by all and sundry. So you used to get those kind of tasks. I suppose that took the monotony off it. And of course, the NCOs then would probably ask you to, if there was one or two backward people, would probably pull you out while the lesson was on and say, "Take these two to one side," and that. And I used to remember that when we went on drill, that we had a lance corporal called Smith, and he had a bit of an impediment in his speech, and I used to do the demonstration of the drill and give the words of command and that he couldn't do. So we used to get little tasks like that.
Did you do any tactical training in those 3 months?
Oh, yes, we did left and right flankers, frontal attacks, bayonet drill, digging in, pillbox attacks, and so forth. Thrown hand grenades at a quarry up at Stannard. We used to march to Whitburn, fire our rifles on the range at Whitburn, and our GPMG gun, the Brens, and then we had a 30 yards range in the camp, which we used to do for zeroing our rifles in. And of course, as the Sten gun, as it was known, came into being, well, we used to fire the Sten on the 30 yards range. I think it caused more casualties than what it inflicted upon the enemy.
How did you do that?
Well, it was a very mass-produced weapon, and one of its main failings was the working parts were quite heavy on the spring, and if you didn't have your safety catch on, the bullets were 9mm in the magazine, and one of the things was, it was like a piece of steel tubing to the back, with a small shoulder pad on, and the working parts were quite heavy, and if you bumped into anything, the working parts came back behind the spring and shot off around. There was quite a number of accidents happening in that way. And of course, the thing about it was, you could unscrew the barrel, which was about 6 inches long, and throw it away and get a new barrel and fit it on. They were very cheap and nasty, nothing like the Thompson submachine gun, which was the replaced. And then, of course, as the war went on, they then produced the Sterling, or improved the Sten, because there was these accidents in. And you could jam your fingers quite easily on the ejection opening cover, which this, once it started firing automatic, this great working part, which was very heavy, came backwards and forwards, and before you knew it, your fingers were jammed in and the gun stopped and you had a black fingernail.
You mentioned tactical movement. What was it based on? The whole idea of World War One advancing in the line presumably gone by now.
Oh yes, well, the technical wording of it was fire and movement, which meant that you were in sections, and those sections then were given a task. For instance, if you were going to put in a platoon attack into an enemy position, the platoon, which was comprised of a platoon headquarters, which was the sergeant and the officer and the runner, and that then the three sections were commanded by corporals. They had probably 10 to 12 men in it, and in each of the sections there was a brain gun and a lance corporal, and he was the commander of the brain gun. Now, whatever the technical side of it was done was decided by the officer. And let's take, for instance, that we're going to do a left flanker. So he'd probably say one and two sections will move down by the perimeter of that small copse, and we'll wait there till the section that he commanded would give, while they were moving, would give cover and fire. Now, while they were moving down and giving cover and fire, because of the First World War, where they inflicted people wounds and casualties and that, because they were bunched together, every man was about 5 yards apart, and then the sections were broken down into small groups again of about three people. So when you moved, and because of aerial attacks and this kind of thing, and also artillery fire could come down on you, you moved in like what they call pepper pot situation, where three men would move, giving cover and fire by the other nine. Then another three men would move, and you move forward in a pepper pot area like that. And then, of course, you also learned at that stage company attacks, where you had three platoons doing an attack. And therefore, the same principle, but instead of having them in sections, you had them in platoons. And, of course, the thing about it was that the firepower you could put down. And then when you had your platoons in, you had your two-inch mortars, which you could put down with HE or smoke or phosphorus kind of weapon. We also had, at the beginning, a small anti-tank weapon, which was called the Boys, which was like a big elephant gun, which was neither use nor ornament. And then later on, we got the two-pounder, which was more efficient. And of course, then, when you after you've done your platoons and this kind of thing, you then developed into your battalion attacks, where you had your brain gun carriers, your three-inch mortars, and your anti-tank weapons. And also, you had the machine guns. Most of those people, though, the machine guns, were on attachment to you from other units. I think the Northumberland Fusiliers was one unit, and I think the Cheshire was another unit, where they would come and give you support on your machine gun
Did they teach you to have initiative? You would hear a great deal about awaiting orders before you could do things. But at this stage, we are actually being taught initiative to look at the situation as you found it and to do something?
Well, I would think that one of the main assets of the British Army was you had a corporal in charge of a section, and nine times out of ten, when the general plan had been decided that it was going to be a left flank or a right flank, once those sections moved off, they were under the command of the corporal. The officer couldn't control everybody. If he was going to sustain fire while you were moving, and you were going to move off 500 yards to the left, and they had to wait till he put a very light pistol up saying red over red, and you're going to put in an assault. It was the corporals on the ground that made the decisions and to move forward, and then to go take the objective and go over and through the objective and to find out the positions, the field of fire, to sustain any counterattack. And then the section would come up with the officer, who would then go over the ground that you'd passed over to see if there was any remnants of any enemy or anything in it. So the corporals, really, at the end of the day, after the decision of the officer making the decision which was going to go, regardless whether he stopped with the support section or he went with the assault sections, the corporals on the ground had to move forward and then make the decision once it passed over the objective for the fields of fire to dig in case there was a counterattack. So yes, I think everybody accepted that you had to have the initiative to do that. I think that the corporal does not get the recognition in the army that he should do, particularly in the infantry at that time.
You mentioned bayonet practice and bayonet fighting. How important was that looked upon in 1944, which we're talking about?
Well, I think that the thing about it there was that it gave a man a bit more confidence, because as you went along and you were advancing along to put an assault in, you got the word of command, bullets, which meant you fired. Now, it all depends upon what resistance you got from the enemy, how many times you received that order to fire bullets. But of course, at the end of the thing, when you went onto the assault position and you didn't have a round to fire in the firing position, you also had your bayonet to defend you. And I think it was very important in that sense that the man had something and he could parry off, as they called it, a man with 18-inch bayonet on, and obviously disarm the chap or give him a wound in the arm or something, which meant that you preserved your life against the thing. And I don't think that they could have substituted anything else but to keep the bayonet on. I think it was a bit of a a morale builder than anything else.
Was it at this stage the long or the short bayonet?
Oh, it was the 18-inch bayonet. I think we got the small ones, and that when the army grew in profusion, as you can appreciate, for the second front, and of course, like everything else, supplies was at a premium. And to equip an army of that magnitude and that, I think that to ensure that everybody had some kind of weapon, that they had to bring them in. I think they came in actually from Canada. I think it was called the P4, if my memory serves me right. And but the majority of those were given to home service units and the home guard, which was a substantial force in those days. I remember distinctly that I don't think a weekend went by where there wasn't a training exercises on in Brandsmouth with the Home Guard people.
Being a training, you mentioned parrying. Did you do your training one man against another?
Oh, yes, and we had what they call parrying sticks. You had, it was about a 6 foot long pole, and at one end it had like a boxer's glove on, and the other end it had like a ring. And you lunged forward, and the guy on the other end, you had a, as he positioned the stick, you had to go for the hole with the ring in, and this kind of thing. And of course, if you didn't, you found the boxer's glove on your ear, because he parried you, you'd missed the mark. So yes, we did that kind of. And of course, we had like a sacks full of straw and this kind of thing, which were on these stands and everything like that. And you went forward and stuck the thing and this kind of thing, and twisted your bayonet to get it out and this kind of thing. And yes, you did. I would think probably in your 3 months training, I would think you did about 4 or 5 days that kind of training. And of course, that also involved the unarmed combat side of the situation, where you went and that, and the bloke got hold of your rifle, and they would teach you to, while you were struggling, if you could imagine his force against your force, and you just let go of your rifle, he would fall over, kind of thing. And they'd teach you things like that. And how to kick him with 10, what they used to call 10 lair soles, which was your boot, in his private parts to enable him to release the weapon he was trying to take off you. So we did that, and we did training. A bloke coming at you with a knife and this kind of thing, all in the combat. That was all controlled, that side of the bayonet training. That was done ordinary by your instructors, but the other side of it was done by the physical training people.
You've mentioned hand grenades. What hand grenades were in production at that time that you were using?
Well, it was the 36, the Mills kind of grenade. We used to get these practice grenades and this kind of thing, and what we did was we used to march up to Stanhope, which was some considerable miles away, about 10 or 12 miles away, just to show you that the infantry could march on its feet as well as its stomach. And then we were in this quarry, and we used to have to clean these grenades because they were full of grease, obviously for preservation. And then with a paraffin, I think it was, or petrol or something in this kind. And then we were taught how to carry out the striker test, which the plunger, you took the lever off, the plunger went down. Of course, there was no detonators in this time, and you held it against your web belt, and the plunger came down. And that was to ensure that you'd got all of the grease off the grenade and everything, and when you were going to throw it, that it would carry out the mechanism, because you would then put the detonator in and put the base plug back on. The thing we remember about that is that the base plug always comes back to the thrower, regardless of what it is. It's a phenomenon of the hand grenade. And of course, one of the things that used to be quite funny, and that was you had these dummy grenades, the drill grenades, and you took the pin out, and they said put your left hand forward up in the air and your right hand back, and the leverage and up nut would get you more height and everything to get it over to the thing. And then you had a watch actually where it landed. That was to see if you'd thrown it properly, and also it was very important that you knew where it landed in case it was a blind, because then someone had to go out there with a slam of Anatol and a detonator and blow that grenade. You couldn't leave it in that area, and you couldn't move it, so it was essential. And you would see the recruits and this kind of thing, as soon as threw the grenade, would crouch down behind a sandbag thing of that, and the instructor would be pulling them up, saying, look, it's over there, it's over there. But you couldn't get some of the recruits up. They were just that petrified of the thing. And, of course, as they were all told, the base plug did come back to the area of the thruway. So they thought they were going to get their heads chopped off. But it was later on, when I was an NCO, I think I only had to do, on two occasions, blow a grenade. And I think it was the best slimming device I ever found in my life, walking those few paces to put the amatol down in the gun cotton to blow the grenade.
Quite a risky job.
Yes, but it had to be done, because, as I say, you couldn't go out and move it, because it could be blow up as you moved it.
And that was the responsibility of the NCO
to
do that?
Oh, yes.